Welcome to Rover Talk again. This is another episode, and I'm here with Dan, also known as Wagon Boy TD. Dan, how you doing today?
Good. How are you?
I think we need to record some type of intro music. What do you think? Like just a quick 10-second, you know, little jingle?
Sure. You can be in charge of that.
Why am I in charge of that? Anyway, remember, you can reach us at rovertalk55@gmail.com, Wagon Boys on Instagram as Wagon Boy TD, and, well, Dan is on Instagram. Wagon Boy is the name, Wagon Boy TD. Same as on Bring a Trailer. I am SRI2405 on Bring a Trailer. No, on Bring a Trailer on Instagram. Boy, am I...
Was it a crazy Thanksgiving for you?
It was. It's been a crazy few weeks.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have a lot to talk about today. So we wanted to go over our projects, some little tidbits of information and little tips and tricks that we have. And, of course, we want to discuss a little bit about the market. And we have some special information about the Camel Trophy just on the tail end of that sale that just finished of that disco, which is outstanding. Anyway, Dan, what are you working on?
A couple things. I finished up my ignition coils on my 08. I had went ahead and replaced all 8. And then after I did that, I found that one of them was... one of the new ones was actually faulty. So then I just actually swapped back an old one back into that, and it seems to be working fine, although I'm still going to just replace it with the new one. And then I'm doing some clutch work. I did my fluids on my disco and then found that my master cylinder was kind of toast, and so I'm going to just swap out the master cylinder and the secondary cylinder for that, and that's about it. And then, as you saw, I put new rims.
Oh, my God. If you have...
new rims on my...
Okay. If you own any version of the L322, please go to... Wagon Boy TD on Instagram, and look at how those rims. Okay. So I'll be a little bit up front here. I wasn't expecting that result. Dan sent me pictures when he put them on, just by text message or WhatsApp or whatever, and I thought, shit, that looks pretty good. It's pretty good, pretty good. And then I saw it in person, and all of you are going to want to put those on your car, no matter where you live in the winter and the summer. They just look that cool.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I'm very, very happy with how they look. And, you know, I think it looks really good on, my 06 is silver. I just think, like, the balance with the rubber, the rims, and the fact that I found center caps for the hubs, which was very difficult.
Are you going to give out which model they are?
I sell them. So if you do decide to go the steely route with the Terra Firma 18-inch rims, I can hook you up with the center caps, because you have to have the center caps, obviously, when you're running steelies on your car. But so, I think they look great.
So for those of you that don't know, Dan has a secret talent / skill. I don't know. I really don't know what to call it. But you tell him... You just give him a car, and he'll choose the wheel and tire and the color of the wheel and tire and the combination. And I'm telling you, I mean, I've officially delegated that now. I no longer choose. Dan, this is a car. What do I put on it? And it's always amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I try. It's just a knack that I have. And it's funny that you...
What do you charge for this service?
Nothing. Oh, okay. I don't charge anything for any service.
No, I'm just kidding.
Except for the center caps, if you need those center caps. But it's funny that you say that, because right now I'm having this discussion with someone on an auction site, and there happens to be a classic that's a Roman bronze, a later one at 95. Beautiful color, but it has cyclone rims. And so I've been getting into this discussion with a few people on that site about... how I think, you know, cyclones are completely the wrong rim for a classic, especially a Roman bronze, because to me, like, the Roman is such a luxe color that the Cyclone rims to me are just way too sporty. Like, they are correct. Obviously, Land Rover wanted them, you know, on discos and on classics. But in this particular case, I just feel like the Cyclones are just completely, you know, wrong for a Roman especially. But
and
I just,
it doesn't matter what color you put them. You paint them.
You paint them, but I just do not like, they're, you know, to me, Cyclones are just way too sporty of a rim. And the classic to me is just more straight up luxe, and just the two lines just don't mesh, in my opinion.
I agree with you 100%. So I've been working on a few things this week, one of which is a 200 TDI 1991 two-door disco that will be coming up very soon for sale on Bring a Trailer. And I have a tidbit of information here for all of you that either have a 200 TDI engine in one of your cars or want to buy one with. If it has air conditioning, and this is if, because not all of them do. In fact, I'd say probably think that the majority of Defenders don't. About half the discos do. Range Rovers, almost all of them do. Anyway, here's your tidbit. There are three different brackets for the air compressor, for the air conditioning compressor, which goes, as you look at the engine on the right, on the left-hand side, high up. I think it's the same on right-hand drive. I'm not 100% sure, though. It might be swapped around. But here's the thing. There are three different brackets, right? If you have a disco and your original bracket for some reason is lost or you know, just doesn't work, or you want to replace it, it's an obsolete part.
Yeah, say a prayer.
Say a prayer. Doesn't exist. So that doesn't exist. Then you have two other options. You have a bronze or gold-colored square bracket that goes on Range Rovers, and you have a custom bracket that's sold by several suppliers for the Defender, all right? I think the three are interchangeable from one car to another, but I think the disco one is the most complicated one. Anyway, just to remember that what these three are kind of interchangeable, but then it depends on what type of tensioner you have. Because then again, there are three different models of tensioner.
Yep.
There is a tensioner that goes on to the bracket, which is the original one for the disco. That tensioner in a different form goes on to the bracket for the Range Rover. And if you have a disc, if you have a Defender, the tensioner goes on to the little round cover, which would the little round cover that oh god I'm skipping on right now, the timing belt cover has a little round cover on it. It has three screws. You take that off and you put on a cover that has a little pivot that comes out, and that's where you attach your tensioner. So if you have to do this operation, which I've had to do this week, it's kind of like a mix and match deal. I was lucky because I had a Range Rover bracket and an original disco bracket. However, none of those came with a tensioner, so I had to use a Defender tensioner. And therefore, I had to buy the little cover, which you can buy. I can't remember what supplier it is. But if you look at, you can find it. Anyway, the other thing that changes is when you do this is that if you're using the Defender setup, or any combination that includes the Defender tensioner, you're going to need a bit of a longer belt, because it just the belt for some reason just doesn't make it long enough to go, because the tensioner on the Defender setup is a little bit lower, and the tensioner on the disco setup in the Range Rover is a little bit higher because it goes right onto the bracket. So just know that you can get the same belt a little bit longer, and that should do fine. If you're in the U.S., NAPA Auto Parts has it. So, and they'll quickly cross-reference the original belt, and they'll give you, I wish I remembered the part number right off the top of my head right now, but I don't. It might be belt number 9045 in the NAPA system, but anyway, it's doable, and it is kind of a pain in the ass to do, because you're going to need a second set of hands to take that, the main belt off, the one that goes to the water pump, because it's the tensioner of the power steering pump has just a little bit of play, and so you can just move it just a little bit, but it's doable.
So basically that
was pretty jumbled, wasn't it?
No. But just to like break it down, the hardest part in getting this AC on a disco is essentially the bracket that holds the compressor to your engine, and when you're looking at the when you're looking at your engine face on, it's going to be in that pocket on the left. You'll see like a big empty space, and so the hardest part is finding that bracket that's going to hold your compressor in place, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah.
And guess what? All three of them look completely different.
Yeah.
That's the only good part, is you can't confuse one for another.
So if you're kind of in the hunt for a disco and it has a 200 and people are like, oh, yeah, you can definitely put AC in it. Chances are you actually might have the bracket still attached to the engine, but first finding that bracket is going to be your biggest challenge.
It will be. But just know that you can get a custom one from a custom made one for a Defender, and that one will, I'm sure, will work out as well.
And that is the good news, because there's, as we know, there's a lot of 200 Defenders, you know, crossing the pond like all the time that don't have AC, and you know, people want to know if they can put AC in. I always say yes. It's a lot easier with the Defenders. So.
Yeah, and the other thing, which is kind of obvious, but it might not be obvious, and it wasn't to me, but is buy a new compressor, because they're already prepared for 134A and a new evaporator, and you just put that on. It just makes things a whole lot.
And they're not that expensive.
They really aren't. And you, if you look up, I think the Sandin compressors that are on all of these cars, you can basically put in the old number, and it'll just give you a new number, exact same model with the exact same specifications, just made for 134 instead of R12.
Yeah.
So that's just my little tidbit of information today. And if I don't know how it is in your area, but I find that Napa Auto Parts is substantially better than anybody else at helping you out.
Well, that's
at helping
good.
You out in general. Like when you come with, and if you look on their website too, you can actually put non-European cars,
yeah,
or non-American version cars into their system, and it'll, you know, for
yeah,
parts and stuff like
as
that.
You know, I live like,
I know,
20 feet from a Napa, and it's nice to just be able to just order the part, you know, like you said, European, and walk over there and pick it up.
Yes. And today I drove over here.
Oh, my God. Like, stop with that thing. So I even drove over here in probably one of the most beautiful blue classics. And it just is beyond beautiful. And he came over at twilight. And he was driving west and the sun was setting and reflecting off the skyline, and like just everything about that blue is just amazing. And it's really, you know, I've seen it, you know, since the day you brought it over, and it just looks amazing.
We had a really good repaint done on that one. This car was taken off the road in 2011, and as any 3.5 V8, it's always a problem child, because it is, but you love it anyways. And it's going to go up on Bring a Trailer soon. Probably when I have to go to Spain next week, so I'll be gone for a couple weeks, but I'll put it up on Bring a Trailer when I get back, because there's a few things that I need to buckle up. The main one being that damn odometer, because the odometer stopped. And so I really don't know how to fix an odometer. I don't know how to futz with it. So what I did is I found a new old stock odometer and put it in. So now, and fortunately, the car probably went less than a kilometer until I realized that the odometer had stopped, because at that time I was doing a little bit of breakdown, and what I would do is drive around my garage, around the block and around the block and around the block. And so I have to, for some reason, I think I need to change the cable, because the speedometer the speedometer needle refuses to move.
Now, is it just for reference, and we might have touched on this, is it, I would assume it's a lot more difficult than changing a speedo cable on a series, right? There's a lot more involvement. Or is it the same concept?
Very quickly, I'll run you through. What you need to do, take off the steering wheel. It might sound like a pain in the ass, but boy, are you going to be happy when you do it. take off your steering wheel, which any steering wheel puller from that you can borrow from any auto shop will take it out in a second, right? It's one basically, one nut. Take off the steering wheel just so you can have your time to maneuver. You need to get the front bezel pulled away from the binnacle. You need to remove the binnacle. And with the binnacle removed, with the binnacle just kind of clips in, so it really doesn't have much there. It just kind of clips into the car at the base of the dash, and then it clips on with these little two wire sticks to the bezel that goes around. And from there, you can access the back. Now, this would be great if you had a small child that was very gifted with their hands, because
aren't you training your daughter to do?
I'm trying my best. She's growing so quickly. I'm like, oh crap. Because there are about four screws, two on the main unit that goes into the actual gauge, which you need very small screwdrivers, and you basically have to blind do it. You just have to basically throw yourself over the binnacle and with one hand guide it in and then try to unscrew it.
Right.
And then that will help you pop that out of the actual gauge, and then it's not that difficult. Then you have the whole unit in your hand, and if you need to unscrew the cable, you can unscrew it from there. Anyway, pain in the ass, job to do. But the car got a great repaint in Spain. In fact, it had all the front floors were a little bit rusty, so all those were replaced, completely repaired and coated, so they're going to be good to go. We did the smart thing, which is there's insulation, but the insulation is not glued to the car floor.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
So if you were to drop a bucket of water where your driver's feet are, you can actually take the whole
take
thing
the
out,
mats
clean
out
it, yeah.
And dry it out. And
yeah, so that's going to be – that's an improvement that we did on purpose. And the insulation is not – it's foamy, but it's not like that mole hair insulation that was in there before that you know, basically is like a humidity trap.
Right.
Anyway, got a great repaint. We even took off the front fenders to make sure that, you know, it wasn't rotting from the inside out, which sometimes these do, even though a lot of the body's aluminum. That doesn't mean there aren't metal parts that are bolted to them that can cause corrosion. So body looks outstanding. And it runs pretty well.
Yeah, the front looks awesome. I'm going to post some pictures tonight.
Oh, it also has the grill with the extra couple of headlights.
Yeah, which work.
Which work?
Which look awesome.
They do, so that'll be. It's a very good Caspian blue, gray leather interior, and I have to get the air conditioning charged. It doesn't technically work. Well, I mean, now it could work because we're in the middle of winter, so right? If I turn the air conditioning, it comes out cold.
Yeah,
but no, it doesn't work.
It'll work in that sense, but
I mean, it blows.
Yeah,
we'll leave it at that. Anyway, that one should be going up too. It's a pretty cool car. We put a lot of work into that. Anyway, it has 100 and it had when the odometer stopped at 186,440 kilometers or something like that. I've got documentation of the year 2011 where it had 186,000 and like 340 kilometers or something like that. And that's when its last technical inspection was passed. And when I had it towed to the shop that did the work in Spain just because it didn't have a technical inspection to be driven.
So
it really wasn't, even though it was running and driving. So fortunately, I can kind of trace, but it's going to have an odometer that's at like 20 kilometers right now. I think I've done 21 kilometers on it. It's kind of cool. You look at it like, oh, nice. Brand new car.
I mean, it looks like it. So
yeah, it does look pretty cool. Anyway, Dan. Let's go. Let's get into the market. The market's been really interesting.
Where should we start?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, since we're kind of talking about classics right now,
yes.
Let's talk about the classic that ended this week at a whopping $70,000.
$70,000, which is about $73,500 for the buyer.
Yes.
Right?
Yep. So some people are like, that's
it. It was on Bring a Trailer, by the way.
Yes, it was on Bring a Trailer. Some people think it was insane. Some people say it was a good buy. To me, it probably was one of the best examples of an American version of an example of this classic, mainly because it was in Coniston. It was long wheelbase. It had it was a Southern car, so it was like immaculate where it needed to be. It had an original. It was a one owner car. It didn't. I think it had like 67,000 miles. Like it didn't have like a ton of miles. It had its original brush bar, which I know a lot of people don't care for. I don't like them personally on mine because I think it takes away from the lines. But from an American standpoint, that to have that original brush bar is actually really, really important. And it's it was ordered from the dealership with a brush, even though this one was replaced at some point. And then it had a roof rack, which also was ordered from the dealership. So putting like all of these things together, especially having a green long wheelbase, it just had a lot going for it. And as we say in auctions, if the person who bought it for $70K is happy with it, then we should all be happy and you know, be happy for that person that spent that amount on it. And you know, some people might not agree with, you know, with how much was paid for it, but for being one of the best examples of an American classic, I think it was definitely worth some money.
You know, I think these cars are finally coming into what I think they should be and are worth. And the thing about one of these cars is that it's somewhat of a unicorn, because a single owner car with that mileage and in that condition that clearly hasn't been beat up. And of course, there's a lot of people that will prefer the 4.2, which this one had, and the long wheelbase. You know, I just think you can't find it. And I remember, so a few years ago, about 5-6 years ago, I remember seeing on Bring a Trailer a similar example to this one, and someone paid for it $35,000. And at that time, I thought, holy shit, that's an insane number. And now I go back to it and I think, well, you know, it really wasn't an insane number, because that car is worth twice what, or could be worth, you know, well, maybe not twice, but maybe like 20 or 30 grand, or maybe like worst case scenario, 15. I think this is a great buy. And I think that if it's going to somebody that's going to enjoy it, awesome. But if it's going to a collector where it's just going to be driven seldomly and regularly maintained, I think it's actually an appreciating classic. And I think in 5 years, I think we'll see this car hit $100,000.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think you made a key point there. Is, I mean, how many Land Rovers that are like, you know, we'll just say 2010 as a cutoff, just because that's already been 10 years. How many Land Rovers do you know or that you see? Because you and I, we're looking at Land Rovers every day. How many one-owner Land Rovers do you see, let alone one that's 25 years old that's a one-owner? Like, it just doesn't happen. You know, like, Defenders, on average, all have, like, 5 and 6 owners. Same with any Land Rover, because people dumped them, as you know, because they either got frustrated or they just moved on, you know.
Well,
but
if you think about it from like a Range Rover perspective, the person that bought this car, the most original buyers that bought a Range Rover in their day probably don't want to hold on to it. They didn't buy it to hold on to it. They bought it to have it for 5-6 years or whatever the term.
100%.
And then passed it on and got a new one. Or maybe they were fed up with Land Rovers and bought something else.
But, yeah.
So that's why it's so hard to find something in this condition.
Yeah.
I think it's a stellar buy, and I'm sure the seller is happy because no matter if it's going to be resold or if it's going to be whatever it is, the seller got what they want out of it, and they know that the buyer appreciates what they have.
Yeah, 100%, because you know the seller was rewarded for being that custodian for so many years, and to have, you know, that the new owner appreciate that and paid up to, you know, compensate the original owner for being such a great custodian on it.
I absolutely love this car. In fact, I tried to buy one in this exact spec a few years ago, but then the guy walked out on the sale, and I was like, oh man, I really wanted it. It was a project, but I really wanted it. Anyway, that's what else. So we've seen some L322s.
So let's talk about the, you know, finally, the auction places have, you know, come around to the L322, even though I've literally been saying it on Bring a Trailer for years. But they finally have come around. But we've seen the Mark III's of the L322 really kind of is having its heyday right now. We're seeing a lot of that Mark III coming to auction, whether it's on Cars and Bids or Bring a Trailer. There's been a lot of it's the 2010 through the 2013 L322s come to market, and they're all doing really, really well. I think probably the best buy, if I'm talking about buys, there was a Baltic Blue third gen come up with, not that it had, I think it had like 50,000 miles, and it sold for 30. So to me, I think that is probably one of the best buys. And I know blues really aren't like everybody's cup of tea, but this Baltic is one of the rarer colors, and I think whoever bought that one got a really you know, decent buy. The thing with the Mark III's is, you know, there's still a ton out there though. Like if you do your research and just search for those Mark III's with the mileage between like 40K and 70K, there's actually a huge amount of selection, but the majority to me, I think, are completely overpriced, mainly because we're in that used car market where everything just seems to be insane. But, you know, there's still a ton of options out there for that, for those Mark IIIs. Yeah. But they're seeing a definitely a heyday right now on auction sites.
All right, so I know these aren't your cup of tea, and we always talk about this, but we've also seen a really interesting P38, which is one that I've been trying to buy in Spain for the past, I'd say, about 6 months, which is the P38 with the BMW inline six turbo diesel engine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know,
a manual gear.
I was surprised, actually, that, and I think mainly because I honestly thought that was going to go for a little bit more money than they had.
Okay, so here's the thing about this one, and I'm not, and please, the seller, if you're listening to this, don't take this the wrong way. But so this car is a 1995 DSE, so turbo diesel SE, so it was the leather model, and it had a great repaint, had a great color, had a great look. I really did like it.
And you have to remember, it's the first of the first of the first in that generation.
Yes. The thing about it was that there's a couple of things that I really should have contacted the, I'm sorry, seller, if you're listening, I should have contacted you. But my main question with this car is that the odometer was in miles, and this was a German market car, and
right.
Of course, a lot of people, and we later found out, if you read the feed of the auction, it's kind of interesting, a lot of people in the UK that regularly skied in France bought left-hand drive models because it was easier for them to run around in Switzerland and France and the Alps and, you know, go skiing without having to drive their right-hand drive cars. I guess it might have been the in thing. And this might have been the case for this one, which would make sense why it has miles on the cluster and it's left-hand drive. But that is just kind of a weird thing to me because for those of you that don't know, once these cars are imported, once they're 25 years old, they don't need to be federalized. So you no longer have to, like, change the gauges or anything like that. It can be in its original configuration 100%. So that was kind of the strange thing. And then there was a lot of back and forth about the little light on the cluster that has the temperature control gauges or the climate control gauges, right?
Right.
And there's a little book, and that meant that the HVAC system had something wrong, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And I don't think the seller addressed that properly, and I don't think it was a huge deal, yet it was really talked about. And I think that took away from the car. I also think that this seller, which it bid up to 15 grand, and it was reserve not met.
Right.
I'm assuming the seller wanted 20. That's my assumption.
I mean, I had 18 in that 18 to 20 range. Just knowing what they cost.
And I think that the seller did everybody that is interested in these cars a favor because somebody's got to put the first one on, like you just mentioned.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that a lot of people knew that the P38 was sold with anything else than a 4.6 or a 4.0, the first versions.
Right.
So, anyway, these are very capable cars. The engine, obviously, is not as fast as a 4.6, but then again, the 4.6 isn't that fast.
That's not fast either.
So it's a very cool car, and one of these in a manual is actually pretty fun.
Right.
So I assume that I will have one in the next couple of months. I'm tracking down a few of them. I actually found a 4.0 with a gas engine, a manual transmission, but the guy doesn't respond to me. I'm like, I've been chasing him down for 2 months because I want that car really bad. But anyway, very cool car. I think the price range is about... I think it's good that it went reserved on Met. I think this is, for me, it's 20. And 20 based on the rarity of it and also on the condition of this specific car. But, you know, a lower mileage one could be even more, could be 25.
Yeah.
These are very cool cars. And, you know, a lot is talked about the electrical problems and all that stuff, but it's all very well documented, too. So when you have a problem with one of these...
Someone's encountered it before you.
You kind of know where you have to go.
Yeah.
Right? So unless it's a weird thing like a crimping wire underneath the rear suspension, which was happening to me and was causing the car to short.
Right, yeah.
Which I spent $2,000 trying to figure out. But other than that, the problems are pretty normal, and so it's not that difficult. And I would probably say that BMW diesel engine, which was also used in the 7 Series and in the 5 Series, is pretty bulletproof. Pretty reliable and damn easy to maintain for those of you that might consider this one. And so, Dan, the big seller this week.
That's like what dreams are made of. It was a 1990 disco, but it was the winner of the Camel Trophy in 1990, and I got goosebumps already. Like, it was just so amazing to see something so incredibly rare. I mean, there's only one winner every year, so it's not like there's another one for 1990. Like, it's was just insanity, and of course it you know, had the 200 TDI 5-speed manual, which, you know, I swear by. It just was so amazing. And early on in the auction, I had made this, you know, comment where I was like, you know, it's not about the condition, you know, because if a Camel Trophy doesn't have corrosion or bruises, then it's not a winner. Like, it's not.
No, and that means it was restored, and it's no longer in its original condition.
100%. So I'm like, I don't even need to see, like, the bottom, because you know that there's going to be issues at the disco to begin with, but like, you know, it spent time in the water. Like, I mean, it's just no getting around it. And it just really was an amazing result, which, you know, I've mentioned on my Instagram that I still think it was probably one of the best buys. Like, I know people are like, holy crap, 100 and, you know, essentially, you know, 150 grand to your door. Like, to me, it's such a great buy because you just can't, you know.
It's one of one.
It's one of one. Like, it's like saying, you know, the Oxford, you know, to me, is priceless. So if, like, that ever came up to auction, you know, the Oxford-Cambridge, you know, series that just also is, like, the pinnacle of someone's collection. Like, if that were to come to auction, I mean, that would be, like, $500,000. Like, you just can't make that kind of history up in some of these iconic vehicles. And, you know.
So let me go a little bit into the Camel Trophy. So there's a lot of information on the Camel Trophy, but
Camel Trophy, YouTube videos.
Yeah. Camel Trophy from Camel Cigarettes began in the West German office of the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. And the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, which is the owner of Camel Cigarettes, decided that they were going to organize, in order to promote the brand, a German-only contest for 12 days of off-road adventure navigating in the Trans-Amazonian Highway. And this attracted a great deal of attention. Everybody wanted to be in there. And there were six lucky participants. The Ford U-50s, Jeep CJ5s built under license, couldn't make the 1,000 miles. And so, ever so Land Rover-ish, here came the Land Rovers, who supplied a fleet of, like, purpose-built Range Rovers for the job. And that was kind of how it started. And that's how it became. And then for almost this partnership lasted with Camel, as you see. That's why all of them are in that Camel yellow, and they all have the Camel decals because of then, you know, tobacco companies like we saw in the 40, you know, Formula One, very linked to the automotive industry, of course, for the male consumers and all that. And then for almost 20 years, Range Rovers that started out doing this, and then Land Rovers in different types of configurations did it, and it took you to places like Sumatra and Zaire, which is now Democratic Republic of Congo, probably, and then Siberia and Madagascar and Sulawesi and Australia. And the idea was that it was just the ultimate 4x4 adventure. Now, it is true that they didn't allow anybody else to participate, any other marks. So this was basically a Land Rover and Camel Cigarettes, what you would call it, race. So, and honestly, like, if you have the time to watch some YouTube videos, just look at some of the images, because they really did put these things through hell, right?
Oh, yeah.
And in parts of the world where, you know, I mean, it's not like what you would think. Like, someone might think it's like a Baja race, but it isn't, because Baja nowadays has, you know, it's a race that's like tough as hell, but there's support. This was basically very little support and just, you know, this pack of Land Rovers going through the middle of nowhere in the worst conditions possible and just making it through. There's very little technical support, very little team support, and especially they went through some areas that it was just really hard to try to get a secondary vehicle in there to help you. And this doesn't happen, you know, in off-road races today. Like, if you watch the Dakar, or, you know, the Middle Eastern version of the Dakar, or even, you know, when it was in Africa. And I've done some of the stages of the I've been through some of the stages of the Dakar with, not racing, but through Africa with a 4x4. And it's tough as hell. But there's usually space for, you know, help to come.
Yeah.
And here you see that a lot of places, there really wasn't.
No.
So it was really, really a cool thing. So a lot of people that maybe, you know, don't really, and they nicknamed it the Olympics of the 4x4. So when you look at the price that this car brings, you have to think that this is an actual race-winning example. It's kind of like if you were able to buy a Dakar-winning car, or if you're able to buy a NASCAR-winning car, right? It won one NASCAR-winning car one season, or a pro, you know, something of that. So you're not paying for the engine, the body, and the condition of the car.
You're just literally paying for the history of it.
And I honestly think that it is probably, in my opinion, about $100,000 undersold.
Yeah. I think so too. Like, I really think it was a good buy. I mean, yes, it's a lot of money for a disco, but it's just not any disco.
Yeah, it really is. And the other side of it too is that you have to look at like the Land Rover community and Land Rover world is a little bit different. So there's probably a lot more value into something like this. And I think a lot of us would rather have something like this than, like, for example, a same year, fully restored, brand new rebuilt engine and new interior.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just what it is and what it meant and what the Camel Trophy was, and the fact that that type of race existed back in, between 1980 and I think the last year was 2000.
I mean, for someone like my age and, even younger, and older, that literally, I think, is what got us into, why we love Land Rover so much, Yeah.
And a little tidbit here also of information. The winners of the different Land Rovers were, among others, a VM turbo diesel won in 1987. And you had Defenders. You had 110s in 1988 and 89, a Series 3 in 83, a couple of 90s, Defender 90s, and, well, not Defender, actually, a couple of Land Rover 90s in 86 and 85. So you had a whole different, every Land Rover was able to do it, right?
Yes.
And the majority of them actually finished, which was, a testament to what the car was really capable, of doing, aside from, potential ones that didn't finish because of mechanical failure or driver error, which could also be the case.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very, very cool race. And if you have the time to just, look up a little bit and watch a little bit, of course, back then, every time they'd put these types of races together, there's a lot less, nobody really gave a shit about safety, right?
No way.
It's like, you got to finish, and that's what you got to do. And who cares what happens in the middle?
Yeah. OSHA wasn't standing on the side.
Yeah, really.
It's like, you can't do that.
And it's also kind of interesting, too, that the majority of races and the locations had a lot of water.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, you'd be going up a mountain, and that's perfectly fine. And then in the next stage, you'd be, window deep into water.
Window deep, yep.
And so, of course, you also have to think that some of the places where they held these in that period of time were very underdeveloped. I remember the Democratic Republic of Congo, previously known as Zaire, in 1983, was probably Europe in the 1800s, right? And yeah. I'm not saying this is bad. It's just, they really went to some underdeveloped parts of the world, and it's a really cool thing. So I agree with you, Dan. I think the value of this car I think it's undersold.
I mean, I would love to know who the buyer or buyers were of this, if it was going into a personal collection or something, because it's that even museums like Dunfold and people like that don't even have a Camel Trophy winner. So I would love to know who actually, or the people that won this, where it's going.
Yeah. So if you're listening and
you've heard who the winner was or where it's going.
Or you are the winner.
If you are the winner,
please give us a call. We want
and to. I'll come over.
We really want to know a little bit about the differences here, just by judging on the pictures. they had roll cages installed, custom roll cages installed for the protection of, you know, obviously the people. But if you look at it per se, it still has the interior was the same. In fact, the interior is the same color as yours.
Yeah, it's I mean, mine essentially is the same spec, two door, like everything about it is the same spec except for the color. Yeah.
And I know they didn't have air conditioning, so they didn't have the problem that I have with the bracket or the tensioner. Yeah. And they had double batteries. But for the most part, I know I'm sure they had some electrical fail safes in that, but for the most part, that was pretty much the they were pretty much the standard spec. In fact, they had regular VINs and they had regular VIN plates. So, Land Rover didn't really, it's not like when you see today a rally car.
Right.
That is on the outside, kind of looks like the one on the street, but nothing else is the same.
Right.
And fortunately, they kept the little maps of the route and the little logbook, I guess, here too.
Yeah, there's some. I mean, there's definite provenance with it, and I know one of the guys that was part of the team. He chimed in on the auction, and it was like it was pretty awesome. I wish they would have like shared more, but it was nice to have someone chime in that was part of the team.
Yeah, but the cool thing was too that they really didn't. I mean, they somewhat prepared them. I mean, they had like a skid plate and all that, but for the most part, the car was just kind of left as it was supposed to be.
Yeah,
and I think that was kind of the cool part about showing people that or showcasing to people that this was the version they could
they could actually just go and buy.
Yeah, go and buy one. So that was a anyway. Very cool car. I'm happy that this was auctioned off somewhere like Bring a Trailer so we can all take a look at it and see it.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty awesome. There was a previous Camel Trophy, but that one was on Cars and Bids, right?
Yeah, so the one on Cars and Bids sold for $90,000, but that one wasn't a winner, and that one was pretty toasted, like underneath. It was pretty toasted underneath, and then a lot of the outside decaling and stuff like that was missing and or replaced. But it was part of the Camel Trophy actual, but it just didn't have the same provenance as the one that just ended last week.
Yeah, this one was pretty cool. It also wasn't a winner. It was a Team USA Factory Works truck, which, I mean, doesn't take away from it at all.
No,
it's very cool, but of course, there is a certain value to buying the winner, right? The actual winner. This one was also, curiously enough, a four-door versus a two-door.
Right.
Which I think that I'm not sure if it was.
Does it say what year race this was in?
It was in theory.
Or what year is that one?
In theory, it was 92. In theory, it was 92. But here's the. Okay, so this was commissioned for the 1982 edition of the Camel Trophy in Guyana. And so that one. And it says here it captured the Team Spirit Award that year.
Yeah.
Well, if you're in a Land Rover, you got to have Team Spirit,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. This one was 92. I think in 92 there were some two door examples too, not only or some four door examples, not only the two door, which I think is much cooler. But I mean, it seems to like retain a lot of the original equipment too, like the tracks and stuff like that, which are always kind of cool, and the wires that they would add to the bull bar so you could see where, you could have a reference of where your left and right-hand sides were, not only from the trunk but on a horizontal plane, which is kind of cool.
You mean the wires that run from the brush bar?
Yeah.
They also serve as get the trees lifted and up out of your way.
Yeah, so you don't crush. But anyway, very cool cars. Anyway, if you have the opportunity to buy a Camel Trophy car,
if I had the money, I would have been all over that.
It is a piece of Land Rover history, and it's very cool. So, Dan, I've got some updates on my, just to finish off here. I've been working, well, I'm going to Spain next week. We'll go see what I can find. I bought a Fiat Barqueta.
You did?
I did. A 1996 Fiat Barqueta.
And I would assume it's a manual.
They only sold it. This car came in one configuration, which was 1.8 five-speed manual.
All right.
You can get any other option in it.
And it's for play or for sell?
I don't know. It's probably going to be for sell, but I think we need to play with it a little bit because it's kind of like a Fiat Miata, is what I call it.
And
just a better looking.
I would assume there's not, what year is it?
96.
Oh, so this will probably be the first or second in the country.
I've seen one other one for sale at a dealership in Ohio, I think it is.
Really?
Is it Ohio or Florida? Well, it seems like it would be more Florida, but yeah. Anyway. Somebody's picked up on one. They're very cool cars. You'll see it. It's like a more stylish Miata. It's really the same configuration as a Miata, except for that it's front-wheel drive, not rear-wheel drive, but a very fun little car to drive. Is it rear-wheel drive? I don't know. I'll have to look that up. I saw it and I couldn't pass it up. I'm that dumb. You know when you go see a car and you're like, oh, God, I got to buy this.
Let me guess, it's Ferrari red?
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Of course.
It is. They had a brand new convertible top. Anyway, so I have a Series 2A short wheelbase Santana with a gas engine, which is pretty rare for Santanas. That one I'll be finishing up hopefully within the next, I'd say like a month. And then that one will be coming over here. That one's going to go up on Bring a Trailer, I think. I'm not 100% sure what to do with it yet or where to sell it.
Yeah.
That one's for sale too.
And that Santana has the 2.25?
Mm-hmm.
That's weird.
2.25 gas?
Yeah.
Zenith carburetor?
From Spain?
From Spain. There are very few Santanas with gas engines, but some of them came out.
Someone was loaded back in the day.
Yeah, and I have...
yeah. Jesus. I know it's a Santana, so that's kind of an oxymoron, being loaded and buying a Santana, but you had to have a little bit more money if you're buying a petrol Santana.
Yeah, for sure, because this one has door panels, and it has a headliner.
Yeah, but you have to pay extra to have those...
I know.
Air quotes here, those luxuries.
That's why you're loaded.
Yeah.
You got a gas engine.
You're basically a better off like farmer than the farmer next door.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Anyhow, well, we'll be back in a few weeks. Hopefully we'll get in an episode before Christmas, a holiday special. We'll think of something fun to do for the holidays. I'm not real big on celebrating the holidays. But anyway,
Thank
you for listening to us. Dan, thank you for being with me today again. Remember, rovertalk55@gmail.com, wagonboytd, and sri2405 on Instagram if you want to take a look at all that stuff that we're talking about. And, I'm going to promise the next episode we'll go through some of the emails that we received, which were
really
interesting.
Yes, please.
And hopefully... Next camel trophy that pops up, we'll do a little bit of a fun collab with our friends at the Underpowered Hour.
Yeah.
By the way, listen to the Underpowered Hour. They've been doing some interesting stuff, have some good episodes up.
I'm so jealous of their travels. It's crazy.
We have to start traveling.
I know.
All right. Have a great day. Rest of your day, everybody.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.